Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Americans in China, Encounters with the People's Republic, by Terry Louts, narrated by Paul Heitch. Publisher's note, this audiobook may refer to visual elements included in the print and ebook editions of the book. Preface. In July 1960, I sailed across the Pacific Ocean from San Francisco to Taiwan with my parents and sister. After a calm and pleasant voyage, with a stop along the way in Japan, we disembarked at the port of Keelung on a hot, steamy day and drove for an hour to the capital city of Taipei, where we would live for the next 2 years. I was nearly 14, and it was my first encounter with anything Chinese. The United States had diplomatic relations and a defense treaty with the Republic of China, ROC, on Taiwan, and my father, an Ordnance Corps Army officer, was assigned to the U.S. Military Assistance Advisory Group, MAG. Chiang Kai-shek, who had lost the Civil War to the Communists a decade earlier, made speeches about recovering the mainland, but no one seemed to take his words seriously. While still under martial law, the island nation, some 90 miles off the Chinese mainland, was a poor, sleepy, peaceful backwater in those days. That experience in Taiwan, where I attended Taipei American School, made me wonder about the People's Republic of China, PRC, a land shrouded in mystery that we could only see from a hillside on the Hong Kong side of its border. It made me curious enough to pursue Chinese studies as an undergraduate at Harvard, one of the few U.S. schools offering that option in those days. "That's very interesting," my mother said when I announced my major, "but what are you going to do with it?" She was asking a serious question because there were so few China-related jobs. I simply trusted that something would work out. Yet it was only after college, after serving in Vietnam with the U.S. Army, that my curiosity became more purposeful. The people of South Vietnam feared communism. Many of them had escaped from the North, but their government's alliance with the United States undermined their claims to independence and nationalism. Regarding Bernard Fall's books about Ho Chi Minh's defeat of the French in 1954, made it painfully clear that the United States, perceived as another colonial power, was repeating the same fatal mistakes. The tragic result of our leaders' ignorance of Vietnam, a war fought as a proxy against China, was a wake-up call for me. Understanding our fraught history in Asia had become more than an abstract intellectual exercise. My timing was fortunate. During my graduate school days at Stanford, U.S.-China relations began to improve with the advent of ping-pong diplomacy and President Nixon's historic trip to the People's Republic. I returned to Taiwan, the mainland was still off-limits, for Chinese language study and research on a Fulbright Hayes scholarship. After receiving a Ph.D. in history, I landed a job in New York with the Asia Society's China Council, a national public education program led by Robert Oxnam that connected with American scholars, journalists, business people, and community leaders to provide balanced information on the PRC. Public interest was strong, but there was still a dearth of knowledge. We had yet, for instance, to realize the extent of devastation during the Cultural Revolution. My first trip to mainland China in December 1978 coincided with a major shift in the geopolitical landscape. I was escorting a small group of Americans, members of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations, on a 3-week tour of several cities, starting in the north and ending in the south. On our final day, during a visit to the Huadong Commune on the outskirts of Guangzhou, I tuned in to Voice of America on my shortwave radio and listened to President Carter announcing that the PRC and the United States would establish full diplomatic relations. Our Chinese hosts were thrilled by the news, and considerable toasting and drinking followed. Normalization, as it was called, ushered in a hopeful new era in Sino-American relations. Now that the People's Republic was opening up to Americans, I accepted an offer from the Yale China Association, directed by John Starr, to represent its programs in Hong Kong and China. My wife Ellen and I arrived with our two young sons, Brian and Colin, at New Asia College at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, CUHK, in the summer of 1981, our home base for the next 3 years. Everyone was concerned about Hong Kong's transition from British control to Chinese sovereignty, scheduled for 1997, but with the Sino-British Joint Declaration signed in December 1984, Beijing assured the world that it would be a smooth process. The city, while not a full-fledged democracy, had a strong legal and judicial system, freedom of speech, and freedom of the press, rights that were absent on the other side of the border. Under a policy of one country, two systems, Beijing would assume responsibility for foreign affairs and defense, but Hong Kong could maintain its own way of life as a special autonomous region for at least 50 years after the handover in 1997. In addition to teaching and managing various projects at CUHK, I was responsible for overseeing Yale China's programs with Xiangya Medical School in Changsha and with Huazhong University and Wuhan University in Wuhan, relationships that had been restored after a 30-year absence. On one occasion, some of the young Americans teaching English in Wuhan were accused of being spies. I quickly went there to meet with our Chinese colleagues, who soon put an end to the harassment. It was a distressing experience for the Yale China teaching fellows, and was a potent reminder that suspicion of the United States still ran deep. It also drove home the fact that the success of any American venture depended on having supportive Chinese partners. In 1984, my family and I moved from Hong Kong to New York, where I joined the staff of the Henry Luce Foundation. Founded by Henry R. Luce, publisher of Time and Life magazines, who was born to missionary parents in China, it was chaired by his son, Henry Luce III, and led by Robert Armstrong. The Foundation's Asia program supported the creation of resources, language teaching, library materials, fellowships, faculty positions, policy studies, cooperative research, and cultural and scholarly exchange to increase America's capacity for understanding East and Southeast Asia. Much of my work centered on building cultural and scholarly ties between the United States and China. In addition to trips to the PRC, my travels also took me to Cambodia, Laos, Indonesia, the Philippines, Taiwan, Thailand, Singapore, Vietnam, Japan, South Korea, and North Korea. Of these journeys, the most unforgettable was a trip in the spring of 1989 to review some of the Luce Foundation's grants. I flew from Hong Kong to Beijing on May 29, and after checking into my hotel, took a taxi to Tiananmen Square, where thousands of students had been protesting against the Chinese government for weeks. Red banners with university names were stretched above their tents, and after finishing evening meals, they were lounging about playing cards, writing in their diaries, talking with passers-by. A few of them asked me, "What do the people of America think about what we are doing? Are you allowed to have protests in America? Do you think we can succeed?" Loudspeakers broadcast a steady stream of statements from the protest leaders, interspersed with music, including a new democracy song from Hong Kong. Food, drink, and popsicle vendors were doing a brisk business. I wrote in my journal, "Here and there are piles of discarded jackets and clothing for cooler weather, donated by the citizens of Beijing. There is a good deal of litter and occasional piles of garbage, but for the most part, it looks like organized disorder. Visitors are taking photos of themselves in front of the tents and banners. The students seem terribly idealistic, committed, determined, and cheerful." Late that night, a 30-foot Goddess of Democracy, built by students at the Central Academy of Arts, was brought to the square on four flat carts and plastered together on top of a wooden platform. After it was unveiled early the next morning, directly facing Mao's giant portrait on the entrance to the Forbidden City, thousands of people flocked to Tiananmen to have a look. "You have your Statue of Liberty in America," a man said to me, "and now we have ours here in China." The government labeled it an insult to socialism and demanded that it be taken down. With a sense of foreboding, I left Beijing for a flight to Tokyo and Los Angeles on the morning of Saturday, June 3rd. That night, the nonviolent protest movement was suppressed with brutal military force, and the statue was toppled and destroyed. I was disturbed, perplexed, and concerned about the future. Had young Chinese been misled into believing that American-style democracy could be accepted by a communist regime? What principles would guide U.S.-China relations after the Tiananmen debacle, which China's leaders blamed on the black hand of the United States? Were we destined to live through never-ending cycles of suspicion and distrust? Or would it someday prove possible for Chinese and American interests and values to converge? The relationship between the United States and China has waxed and waned in the years since. But questions like these persist. Questions that have led me to write this book. A Chronology of U.S.-China Relations. 1849 to 69. Chinese laborers are recruited to work in gold mines and to construct the Transcontinental Railroad in America's West. 1872-81. The Chinese Educational Mission sends 120 Chinese young men to New England to study Western science and engineering. 1882. The U.S. Congress passes the Chinese Exclusion Act, which severely limits Chinese immigration to the United States. 1900. Eight nations, including the United States, suppress the anti-foreign Boxer Rebellion. The United States uses some of the indemnity money for fellowships to educate Chinese in the United States. 1911-12. Sun Yat-sen establishes the nationalist Kuomintang Party after the collapse of the Qing Dynasty and founds the Republic of China. 1916-22. The New Culture Movement attacks Confucianism and traditional society as the source of China's weakness. 1919. The May 4th Movement, sparked by the treatment of China in the Treaty of Versailles, marks the birth of modern Chinese nationalism. 1921. The Chinese Communist Party is established in Shanghai. 1925. Chiang Kai-shek succeeds the late Sun Yat-sen as leader of the nationalist movement. Chiang agrees to become a Christian when he marries U.S.-educated Sung Mei-ling in 1927. 1928. China is unified under a single government led by the nationalists. 1930s. The high tide of American missionary efforts to provide medical training, relief work, and Western-style liberal arts education in China. 1931. Pearl Buck's The Good Earth, a sympathetic novel about the lives of Chinese peasants, is a major bestseller in the United States. 1941-45. During World War II, the United States allies with Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists and cooperates with Mao Zedong's communists against Japan. U.S. support is limited to air power. 1943. The 1882 Exclusion Act is repealed, but restrictions on Chinese and Asian immigration to the United States remain in place until the Immigration Reform Act of 1965. 1945. Japan surrenders after atomic bombs are dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. 1945-49. During the Chinese Civil War between the Nationalists and Communists, the United States gives military and economic aid to the Nationalists, despite concerns about widespread corruption and incompetence. 1949. Founding of the People's Republic of China, PRC, led by Mao Zedong, chairman of the Chinese Communist Party, CCP. The Truman administration is charged with the loss of China. Some 10,000 Chinese students and professionals who are not U.S. citizens are stranded in the United States. Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist movement retreats to the island of Taiwan, Formosa. Beijing claims Taiwan as part of China, but the United States continues to recognize the Republic of China, ROC, as China's legitimate government. 1950-53. The United States and PRC are the primary combatants during the Korean War, which ends in a stalemate and a divided Korean peninsula. 21 captured American soldiers decide to go to China instead of returning to the United States, and thousands of Chinese POWs go to Taiwan. American missionaries and businessmen are forced to leave China. Only a small number of Westerners are allowed to stay. 1950-71. U.S. containment policy prohibits any trade or travel between the two countries. The United States successfully opposes the PRC's admission to the United Nations. 1954-55. The first Taiwan Strait crisis over PRC attacks on islands along China's mainland, held by the nationalists. The United States and Taiwan agree to a mutual defense treaty. 1955-70. U.S. PRC ambassadorial talks in Geneva and Warsaw, a series of 136 meetings in the absence of diplomatic relations. 1957. A group of 41 young Americans visit the PRC for 6 weeks, despite a U.S. State Department ban on travel to Red China. 1958. The People's Liberation Army bombards offshore islands controlled by nationalist forces during the Second Taiwan Strait Crisis. 1958. Mao launches the Great Leap Forward to rapidly industrialize the PRC's agrarian economy. 1959-61. An estimated 30 million people die during the Great Chinese Famine. 1964. The PRC successfully tests a nuclear bomb. 1966. The National Committee on U.S.-China Relations is established to promote discussion about reconsidering Washington's containment policy. The Committee on Scholarly Communication with the PRC, CSC-PRC, is founded to sponsor short-term academic exchanges, mainly in the sciences. 1966-76. The Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution, Mao's bid to reassert his control over the CCP, leads to massive social, economic, and political turmoil and bloodshed. 1971. American ping pong players visit China, the first sign of a thaw between Beijing and Washington. National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger secretly visits Beijing to lay the groundwork for President Nixon's trip to China. The PRC is admitted to the United Nations, and the ROC, Taiwan, is forced to withdraw. 1972. President Richard Nixon meets Mao and Zhou Enlai and signs the Shanghai Communique, acknowledging that Taiwan and China agree there is only one China. 1976. Death of Mao Zedong and the arrest of the Gang of Four, who are blamed for the Cultural Revolution. 1977. The National Association of Chinese Americans, NACA, advocates for diplomatic relations between Washington and Beijing. 1978. Deng Xiaoping launches the era of reform and opening to modernize China. Wei Jingxiang posts a manifesto on Democracy Wall in Beijing, calling democracy the fifth modernization. 1979. Washington establishes full diplomatic relations with Beijing and breaks diplomatic relations with the ROC on Taiwan. Deng Xiaoping visits the United States for talks with President Carter. The U.S. Congress passes the Taiwan Relations Act to maintain unofficial relations with Taiwan. 1980. The United States and China sign a trade agreement. Business, scholarly and cultural exchanges expand, and American news organizations establish bureaus in Beijing. China joins the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. 1982, the Reagan administration signs a third joint communique with the PRC, stating that the United States intends to reduce gradually the sales of arms to Taiwan. 1983-84, Deng Xiaoping announces the One Country, Two Systems policy to reassure the people of Hong Kong and Taiwan that they will retain considerable autonomy after reunification with the PRC. 1983-84, the CCP promotes a campaign against spiritual pollution to limit Western influence. 1987, the anti-bourgeois liberalization campaign demonstrates renewed conservative Chinese concern over imported Western values. Martial law is lifted, and Taiwan becomes a constitutional democracy. 1989. Pro-democracy protests take place in Beijing's Tiananmen Square and other cities in China. The People's Liberation Army brutally ends the movement on June 4. The Bush administration imposes economic and military sanctions in response. The Committee of 100 is established in New York City to advance U.S.-China relations and to advocate for the rights of Chinese Americans. 1990. President H.W. Bush signs an executive order allowing as many as 40,000 Chinese students to stay in the United States. Dissident Fang Liju is allowed to leave for the United States after taking refuge in the U.S. Embassy for a year. 1992. Deng Xiaoping's southern tour of China signals the resumption of economic reforms that had been paused after the 1989 Tiananmen crisis. 1993. The United States claims that the Chinese ship Yinhe is carrying chemical weapon materials to Iran. The ship is boarded and no evidence is found. 1994. President Clinton's administration ends its policy linking Most Favored Nation, MFN, status for China with its progress on human rights. 1995-96. Taiwan's President Lee Teng-hui visits Cornell University despite PRC protests. During the third Taiwan Strait crisis, Beijing fires missiles into Taiwan's territorial waters to warn the ROC government against independence. The United States deploys two carrier battle groups to the Western Pacific in response. 1997-98. Presidents Jiang Zemin and Bill Clinton hold meetings in Washington and Beijing, the first summits since 1989. 1997. The British colony of Hong Kong is returned to Chinese sovereignty. Beijing promises that Hong Kong can retain its own system for 50 years. 1999. Taiwanese-American scientist Wen Ho Li is accused of giving classified information to the PRC, but the case against him is not proved. A U.S. plane bombs China's embassy in Belgrade, Kosovo, killing three Chinese citizens. Refusing to believe it was an accident, Chinese citizens take to the streets to demonstrate in major cities. The Portuguese colony of Macau is returned to Chinese sovereignty. 2001. A U.S. spy plane and PRC fighter jet collide over the South China Sea. The Chinese pilot is killed, and the U.S. crew is held for 10 days on Hainan Island. The PRC is admitted to the World Trade Organization, WTO, with U.S. backing, which provides a major boost to its economy. 2003. President George W. Bush warns Taiwan President Chen Shui-bian against seeking independence. 2008. President Bush attends the Beijing Summer Olympics despite protests over repression in Tibet. 2010. China surpasses Japan as the world's second-largest economy. Dissident Liu Xiaobo receives the Nobel Peace Prize but cannot accept in person because he is in prison in China. 2011. The United States announces a pivot to Asia to counter China's growing power. 2012-13. Xi Jinping is elected General Secretary of the CCP and President of the PRC. He consolidates his power and warns against the dangers of Western values. President Obama and Xi Jinping meet at the Sunnylands Estate in California to discuss climate change, cybersecurity, U.S. arms sales to Taiwan, North Korea's nuclear program, and other issues. 2015. The United States warns China against building military outposts on islands in the South China Sea. 2017. President Trump hosts Xi Jinping in Florida for discussions on North Korea and trade in April. Trump makes a state visit to China. 2018. The Trump administration imposes substantial tariffs on China for the alleged theft of intellectual property and other unfair trade practices. China responds with its own tariffs on U.S. goods. 2019. Uyghur Muslims are detained in mass internment camps in Xinjiang. The U.S. Congress passes the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, which mandates an annual review of Hong Kong's autonomy to justify its special trading status with the United States. 2020. Coronavirus disease, COVID-19, erupts in Wuhan, disrupting global trade and travel and initiating a downward spiral in U.S.-China relations. China passes a national security law to crack down on pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong. President Trump signs an executive order ending Hong Kong's preferential trade status. The United States withdraws the Peace Corps from China and shuts down the PRC consulate in Houston based on charges of spying. China closes the U.S. consulate in Chengdu in retaliation. Both countries impose restrictions on journalists. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo declares that the era of engagement with the Chinese Communist Party is over. Fears of a new Cold War between the United States and China increase. Introduction: A Tale of Two Chinas. In the summer of 1957, the Chinese government invited a group of young Americans who were attending a World Youth Festival in Moscow to visit the People's Republic of China, PRC. The U.S. State Department sternly warned them against accepting. If they did so, their passports, stamped not valid for travel to those portions of China, Korea, and Vietnam under communist control, would be revoked, fines could be imposed, and they might be liable to prosecution. No such restrictions applied to the Soviet Union, which established diplomatic relations with the United States in 1933. President Eisenhower called the potential trip ill-advised. If they made the journey, said Undersecretary of State Christian Herter, they would be willing tools of the Chinese communists. Several decided against going to the PRC, but 41, most of them students, were willing to defy the U.S. government. The Chinese embassy issued visas on separate pieces of paper so their passports would have no evidence of their having been in Red China. The New York Times reported that a brass band blared and 1,000 flower-bearing Russians waved as the exuberant group set off on the Trans-Siberian Express from Moscow Yaroslavsky Station. A wildly enthusiastic crowd of young Chinese greeted the delegation when they arrived 1 week later at the Peking Railway Station on August 23. As soon as they stepped on the forbidden land, wrote a Reuters correspondent, they were surrounded by handshaking, clapping, back-slapping Chinese who pressed flowers into their hands. The cheering redoubled when one of the Americans unfurled a large Stars and Stripes flag which the Russians had made for the youth festival. The Chinese began singing John Brown's Body, and everyone joined in chanting, "Long live world peace." From their hotel, a short while later, the Americans issued a statement that they regarded the visit as an important step toward free interchange between China and the United States. They wanted not only to learn about contemporary China, but also hoped to give the Chinese people some understanding of our own.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?